This is West Virginia Morning. I'm Teresa Wills. A committee of lawmakers in West Virginia heard scathing testimony Thursday from a former state Supreme Court administrator. It's part of an ongoing investigation into the possible impeachment of one or more justices on the state's high court. Senior reporter Dave Mistich joins us now to talk about a witness who was much anticipated and shared some interesting perspective on how the court operated, particularly Justice Alan Lawfrey. Dave, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Teresa. Of course, you know, it's Friday. These impeachment proceedings are back in, so here I am again.
So testimony on yesterday, came from former court administrator Steve Canterbury. Tell us a little bit about how he plays into all this and what he had to say.
Well, Steve Canterbury had been with the court. He's been in that role of administrator since 2005. That said, he has quite a bit of experience and has worked very closely with a lot of different justices and makeups of the high court's bench, as well as other staff that works there within the court. We've heard about the strained relationship between he and Justice Lawfrey, who has been the main focus of these proceedings. Of course, I should point out the entire bench is under scrutiny for possible impeachment, particularly by way of this House Resolution 201. A lot of this started, you know, last year when reports of high dollar spending by the court, on office renovations for these justices. Justice Lawfrey said he wasn't involved in those making of decisions and had blamed much of all this spending on Canterbury himself. There's evidence of a drawing that Lawfrey made of how he wanted his office to look. And here's Canterbury being questioned by committee counsel about how involved Lawfrey was in these renovations.
A couple of times daily, he would check in and ask questions and be very specific about his displeasure about some things, sometimes remarkable minutia. He wrote, I don't know how many email scores, perhaps hundreds of emails, and they were all around the clock. If you look at the emails, I think you'll find a few of them are midnight or one in the morning. He was very involved, and he was more involved than any other justice by a long shot.
Any other justice that you've ever worked with during your tenure with the court?
That's right.
And I'd like to back up a little bit here. Before being elected to the state's high court, Justice Lawfrey, he clerked for Justice Spike Maynard. Canterbury said Lawfrey's character from clerk to justice was a transformation. He described that transformation as extraordinary. I should point out that Canterbury described an alleged sexual harassment incident involving Lawfrey. Canterbury said he became aware of an incident between Lawfrey and a female employee. He talked to Lawfrey about it, and by the way he described it, any concerns did not persist. Canterbury called it water under the dam, and that was that. This came up a few times during testimony. I certainly don't want to minimize it, but Canterbury described it in a way that seemed isolated and that not much was made of it. Canterbury also spoke about Lawfrey's use of state vehicles, as well as conflicts over supposed court policies on travel and home offices. We've come to find out, you know, through the course of this testimony, these proceedings, that those policies did not exist. The evidence they're making use of in regard to this are memos showing Justice Robin Davis. Others question the use of vehicles without providing a destination or purpose.
Lawfrey fired Canterbury in early 2017. We've heard that he lashed out at the justice and threatened to go to the press. This brought about a word of the day type of moment. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, before we get into all this, let me, you know, say it with me. Simulacrum, that was the word of the day yesterday. Canterbury described being fired, which came on a majority vote from the bench when Lawfrey was Chief Justice. This is early 2017. Here he is recalling the interaction with Lawfrey when he was fired. At the end of it, you'll hear him turn his attention to the committee, whose members wondered what he meant by that word. Again, simulacrum.
Well, every cloud has a silver lining. At least I will not have to work for a simulacrum of a chief like you. He said, what did you call me? And I said, well, I described you as a simulacrum. He said, what's that word? What's it mean? And I said, look it up. And I'm literally getting my things and getting up. And he said, how do you spell it? I found that to be puzzling. And I said, well, figure that out yourself or something like that. I'm not going to spell it for you. and I left. I see a lot of puzzled expressions about what simulacrum means. Simulacrum means an elaborate fraud. It seemed the best word to describe him at the time. I was angry.
Later, and I think this perspective is key, Canterbury testified that justices may have believed that the West Virginia Ethics Act, which would help guide them in the spending of state resources or the use of vehicles or whatever the case may be, that Canterbury says he thinks justices would have believed it applied to different branches of government and not to the judiciary. Asked if he thought if the justices believed that they were above the law, Canterbury made a distinction referencing their deciding of cases. He said that that's their job to determine appeals cases based on law and ultimately the Constitution. He said that doesn't mean they are above it. So that was, you know, a wide range of testimony from, you know, Mr. Canterbury there.
So we've heard 5 days of evidence and testimony on these possible impeachments. What do committee members make of all this?
Well, you know, I think that depends on who you ask, really, depending upon party. Although, generally speaking, I think committee members have gotten a lot of perspective on the operations of the court in recent years, particularly on policies that haven't properly been spelled out, and definitely the budget aspect of this whole impeachment deal. I spoke to Chairman Schott about his take on Canterbury's testimony.
Well, we had a key witness who was involved in many aspects of the court for almost 12 years, and so I think he's added a lot of information and filled in some gaps. Yes, we're making some progress. I can't say that all his testimony is unchallenged, but it certainly adds to the overall picture.
But the Democrats, though, they seem to be getting a little anxious. They seem to have heard what they need to about Justice Laufrey, not only through the proceedings, but also through the Judicial Investigations Commission and the legislative audits of the court. A lot of that information is what we've heard again and again and again through testimony. Here's Barbara Fleshour. She's the ranking Democrat on the House Judiciary Committee.
Well, I think that we started out with 3 investigations with a whole lot of evidence, and that we've heard more. And I have personally heard enough about Justice Laufrey, and I remain concerned about the August 14th deadline. You know, we started this in June, and we've gone pretty slowly.
Yeah, Democrats definitely seem to be looking at this quite differently, and you can hear it in what Delegate Fleshour has to say right there. Mm-hmm. What do you look forward to now that we have heard Canterbury's testimony? They're certainly not done with witnesses, though, right?
Well, we've learned that the committee has also issued a subpoena to Laufrey's wife. They expect to delay her testimony as far as her being called a witness until she has retained an attorney. They're also looking to serve a subpoena to a moving company who took this much talked about furniture to the Laufrey home. Also, the group of lawmakers has yet to finalize rescheduling a tour of the Supreme Court offices, which is to include a pool of media accompanying delegates. If you remember last week, there was a whole dust up over all that. As they finished the day yesterday, they said they plan to alter the schedule of proceedings, which have begun in the past on Thursdays, and change that to other days of the week. We're basically just waiting on them to iron out those details and let everyone know.
Well, Dave Mistich, senior reporter here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Thanks for coming in and giving us the update.
You're welcome, Teresa. Thanks for having me.
For more on these possible impeachments, visit us online at wvpublic.org. 1 in 5 children in West Virginia experiences food insecurity. The state has earned high marks for feeding kids during the school year, but only a fraction of them use the summer food program. As Molly Bourne reports from southern West Virginia, transportation in the state's most isolated areas can be a significant challenge.
Warncliffe is a tiny community deep in the hills of Mingo County, in a rural corner of southern West Virginia. The road there is narrow, with the signature hairpin curves of this region. A Jeep SUV stocked with enough food to feed 50 kids makes the hour-long round trip 5 days a week from the community center over the mountain to the local fire hall. On this day, kids are laughing and doing crafts on pink plastic tablecloths before lunch. Janet Gibson is one of the volunteers. She grew up right across the road from the fire hall.
I've watched these kids grow up. Just want to make sure they've got something to eat. We've got a lot of parents doing foster care here.
And a lot of these kids don't know what it is to get a hot meal.
These kids are getting lunch through the West Virginia Department of Education Summer Food Program, funded by the USDA. Historically, this program has been underused nationwide. Experts say transportation is one of the largest barriers to participation in rural and urban areas. And about 3 years ago, West Virginia was the focus of extra scrutiny.
I guess you could say we were kind of a target area for them because they saw that our participation was low in comparison to other states across the United States, especially in the Northeast region.
That's Samantha Snuffer-Reeves from the state's Office of Child Nutrition.
Once they came here, they really understood that you don't go from county to county in 20 minutes. The issue is the transportation and the geography of our state, getting kids to the mills, getting the mills to the kids.
Her office oversees about 450 summer feeding sites across West Virginia. They're at summer schools, community centers, vacation Bible schools, and at programs like Energy Express. The state served 600,000 meals and gave out nearly $1.8 million in federal funds as reimbursements to those sponsors last year. West Virginia excels in providing food during the school year and ranks number one in the country for school breakfast participation among low-income children. That's according to the Food Research and Action Center, a Washington, D.C. nonprofit. But those stats look much different when school lets out. FRAC ranked West Virginia 44th in summer food program participation. And according to the USDA, West Virginia served fewer students during the summer in every year between 2014 and 2017. Here's Crystal Fitzsimons from FRAC.
West Virginia feeds about 10,000 children through the summer nutrition programs, which is only a fraction of the 130,000 kids who eat school lunch during the school year. West Virginia is very committed to making sure that their kids do not go hungry. Unfortunately, West Virginia is a very rural state, and it can be hard to run the summer nutrition programs in rural areas.
Cheryl Mitchum knows the struggle well. She's the executive director of the Larry Joe Harless Community Center in Gilbert, which runs the feeding site in Warncliffe. Last year, she rounded up a team of volunteer drivers to make the trips, sometimes taking her own car to deliver the food.
We're going to travel 45 minutes to take food to children that attend Gilbert Elementary, which is 1 mile from our center. So I think that that tells you alone, not only distance, but commute time is so heavy for a burden.
She got an $18,000 grant in May from the Washington, D.C. nonprofit No Kid Hungry, and she bought a Jeep and dedicated the vehicle to the summer food program. She also added another, more remote site where they're feeding more than 40 more kids. Volunteers still help deliver, but Mitchum has been able to reassign some to other needs. There are fewer summer food sponsors in Mingo, Wyoming, and McDowell counties, all in the southern coalfields. The state isn't really sure why, but it recently honored Mitchum for her work to reach some of Mingo's most vulnerable children.
One person in the entire state to represent us as a summer champion. Cheryl, on behalf of you and your volunteers and the work that you've done, you are the 2018 summer champion for the state of West Virginia.
Again, Samantha Snuffer-Reeves.
They go into the haulers of West Virginia. They deliver the food to these kids. Those are the type of programs that we really see being effective.
There's at least one spot outside of the southern coalfields where a food service director has found a creative way to reach kids. Lewis County officials rehabbed an old yellow school bus 3 years ago, creating a lunch counter style interior on one side with booths from old school bus seats on the other. Laminate flooring gives it a mobile cafe feel.
White milk.
I always take white milk here.
White milk?
Yeah, every day. And I come here, I take white milk.
It's good for you.
Yeah, on a hot recent weekday at the Lewis County pool in Weston, kids lined up at the back of the bus for pigs in a blanket, cheese, and chocolate milk. Julie Williams is a secretary for the county food service director.
When you pull in, the kids are there waiting for you. And that's a good thing. They know you're coming.
A pilot program from the USDA gives public assistance cards to kids in six states and two Native American reservations during the summer. West Virginia isn't among them, but FRAC says such programs have helped to reduce food insecurity. Back in Mingo County, the Harless Center team plans to expand its reach even further next year. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Molly Bourne-Williamson.
Classically influenced, eclectic pop maestro Kishi Bashi locally sourced a quartet of Appalachian-based string players for his performance on Mountain Stage. Here he is performing Can't Let Go Juno for our Song of the Week.
It's a new day, another full of heartbreak. And every time I check in on myself, I'm drinking my soul away. And every time my phone lights up, my heart keeps skipping enough to give up. You know the better days still remain. I cannot be inside forever. Who knew my arms renew? That we could never be together unless we do a deed we can't undo. And even if we sing this song, we could be right, but we could be so wrong. Feed the dream, does it seem now we're staring at the sun?
That was Kishi Bashi performing Can't Let Go Juno live on Mountain Stage. To hear this and more, tune in Friday and Saturday nights at 8 right here on West Virginia Public Broadcasting.